Well, good morning, everyone. We appreciate you all taking time to come out this morning. This is kind of our annual thing now, and it's been working out pretty well for Fluviana County. We hope it works out well for our state and federal legislators and their staff. We've got some formal business to take care of on the front end, so we'll do that, and then we'll go around and do some introductions. So, Mr. Chair?
I will now call the meeting of the Board of Supervisors to order.
We're going to refrain until...
That's right, because y'all don't have the third one yet. All righty. All righty, we will start with introductions. I will start it, and we can go around in this direction, and as we go around, if everyone around would just name and what your title is. I'm Mike Sheridan. I'm Chair of the Board of Fluviana County.
Tony O'Brien. I'm on the Board of Supervisors representing the Rivanna District.
Stephen Harvey. I'm Congressman Garrett's Outreach Director based in Charlottesville.
Rob Bell, Delegate to the 58th District, which for Fluviana's purposes is the western two-thirds of South.
Mark Peake, State Senate 22, and I have all of them.
I'm George Goodwin, fortunate enough to work for Senator Peake.
Charity Howe, I'm the Outreach Representative for Senator Mark Warner, and I do Outreach in Fluviana County.
I'm Shirley Stewart. I'm on the Fluviana School Board representing the Rivanna District.
I'm Carrie Johnson, Chair of the Fluviana School Board.
Chuck Winkler, I'm Superintendent for Fluviana County Public Schools.
Brenda Dillon, Executive Director for Instruction and Finance for the schools.
Christina Treadway, Clerk of the Circuit Court.
Bill Sheridan, Commissioner Groom.
Eric Hess, Sheriff.
Linda Lenher, Treasurer.
Good morning, David Blunt, Legislative Liaison for the Counties and the TJPDC.
Good morning, Kelly
Blanger
Harris, Clerk of the Board of Supervisors.
Jennifer Edwards, Economic Development,
Fluviana County. Eric Dahl, Deputy County Administrator, Finance Director. Steve Nichols, County Administrator.
Tricia Ether, I represent the O'Malley District of the Board of Supervisors.
Could have any opening remarks from our legislators? I'm sorry. I say that as soon as you take a bite. I looked down. I looked up. I went, oh shucks.
I'd rather just listen. I mean, we can have a conversation there. I don't know.
Yeah. Answer questions. I just point out this past session after we met with y'all last year. Two things I think were helpful for the area. One was education. We did a lot, carried a lot of bills for teacher licensure to help address the teacher shortage. I don't know if it's kicked in yet, but we tried to help some things. It sounds like not, but we carried a lot of bills. The House carried a lot of bills. The governor had some proposals, and we rolled those all in and made some significant strides for helping to hopefully make it easier to get teachers in our counties. And the other one was a water EPA water quality DEQ situation. A lot of counties were going to have to upgrade their water treatment facilities to eliminate ammonium nitrate based on EPA guidelines. It was going to be a problem for counties, and we eliminated that. I think statewide, saved about $500 million. So those are two things that I think a lot of the counties were interested in, and that's all I have to say. I'll answer some questions.
All right. Anything else? Okay. All right, we're going to start off with the public schools. Mr. Winkler.
First of all, thank you for the opportunity to meet with us. Thank you all for your time this morning. Some of our main issues that we're facing, as always, is the funding aspect. As I look at the budget and look at the governor's proposed budget, I guess I have a question. I see for FY20, he has a proposed budget, 3% for all state employees. Of course, for us, it'll come down to SOQ positions. Where do you stand on supporting that? How can I help you support that for our employees, et cetera, et cetera?
The governor's budget at this point is just, I'm going to say a fiction, but it's a roadmap, I guess. And until we get there, until I'm not on finance in the Senate, they're going to go through. There's going to be a lot of tax discussion in this upcoming session and some funding. So I understand the desire to get raises for our teachers. But as far as the budget discussions, there's been no discussion at this point amongst us.
This is what it means to be part-time. We have not had any committee meetings, commission meetings, panels, subcommittees, or anything. So we're looking at the same information. If we're not on the Finance or Appropriations Committee that you're seeing, revenues look better than they... We've done this for enough years that, especially in the depths of the recession, we came in and said, revenues are terrible. That's not true this year. I guess we would ask, or I would ask, that since we don't yet know what will be available, tell us your priorities. I say this every time. And then understand that there's your priorities and then there's the county's collective priorities. And if the county's collective priority is we want the money for teacher pay more than all the other things we're being approached about, then I think that impacts us. So if, in fact, if it's yours, that's great. If it's everybody's, that's even more significant. That's what I would ask you to help us with, if you're asking how to help.
Sure.
Mr. Winkler, can I add one thing onto that?
You can add whatever you want.
Well, I just, when we're talking about this, I went to a meeting up in Fredericksburg, and I'll just throw a statistic out at you that was given up there. As far as teacher salaries go across the country, we're ranked 31st. But that's a little skewed. If you take District 8 out, which is the Arlington area where we send money in as a state to supplement the teacher salaries because they have to compete with Maryland, you take District 8 out, we drop to 46th or 47th. I'm not sure which. So that will tell you where the priority will lie throughout the rest of the state if you take away the Arlington-Alexandria area.
I think that's a terrible statistic.
I'd like to add that according to the U.S. Department of Education website, we are $8,000 below the national average, even including the larger districts in the north.
It's interesting that you say that because whenever I meet with somebody from Northern Virginia, Alexandria, Arlington, Fairfax, they tell us that they are sending 30-40% of their money to schools to come down here. So I will have to, I'd like to see that study that says that we're kicking in money on top of that. Generally, the counties that
It's a thing called cost of competing.
COCA. The most of the money runs through the composite index, which Urbana gets more than other places like Arlington. I think the composite index for Arlington is 80. Yeah. But on top of that, then the Northern Virginia communities have received this COCA, and they like it because, of course, it doesn't run through the index whereby they get 20 cents on the dollar. And then there's some other things that are per capita. So it's not COCA directly, but they like that because that's also per student rather than through the formula. Flavanna, anything that can run through the formula does Flavanna better because you're below 50 on the composite index. What's the current composite index for?
3.37.
Does everybody know what the composite index is? It's the most important number that nobody pays attention to, and it means hundreds of millions of dollars in distribution. And you're lower than Almar, higher than Green in my district. So.
I think related to that, with more than 50% of our budget being from the state, when there are last-minute changes with the state budget, when there are delays in passing a budget, it makes it very difficult for us to budget and plan for salaries and issue contracts because so much of it's driven by the state. And a good example of this is when we found out in August that we were not going to get our entire tax revenue from June. But to find that out in August makes it very difficult for us to plan and manage our funds.
We are very well aware that the later our budget negotiations go, that the more stress it puts on the counties. It's one part of the process you have when you have General Assembly where both houses are separated by one vote and you have a governor who's a different party to both both of them. It was a lot to negotiate this year.
Now, this is the off year, I think everybody understands, but if we have a budget, this is our adjustment year. So on occasion, there's been no agreement reached, and this is the time we can say, all right, fine, we just go back to the baseline budget. That said, almost every time we find a compromise to get through the additional revenues that are coming.
And we are looking at additional revenues this year, which is better than all the past years Rob's had to deal with.
Can you tell me whether or not, you may not be able to speak to this, whether there's any discussion looking at raising the average teacher pay from an SOQ-based position? In other words, we get two sets of money, one based on our elementary teachers and one based on our secondary teachers. And it hasn't gone up in the last couple of years, I would say significantly. I'm not sure exactly what that number is. But it's below, certainly below the national average, and it's below what we're reporting from Virginia's average, I believe, from how the type of funding. Is there any talk, I understand it would be premature right now, was there any talk last year in looking at raising that number? I don't believe it's over 50,000. It might be for secondary teachers, right?
Yeah, we don't serve on the budget committee, so
okay.
I'm not happy to answer if we have it. I mean, in terms of the prioritization, the key is going to be if nobody else at this table asks for any money.
Yes.
I'm not being funny. That's how this goes. And then
I don't think they will. Sheriff's Department is not going to.
Sure. And then none of my other counties. Then this room is not the only place that people have requests. And we are in the just Region 10s here. We're in the mental health space and looking for very significant expenditures beyond what we've been spending because people are literally being left without care. All of that's going to be what ends up in the budget. What I'm saying is not anything new.
Sure.
But if you guys, gals, collectively say this is our number one priority, we did a lot in the law enforcement space in the last 5 years, we're going to let that not be the priority this year to the schools, then that's something we can take back to Richmond and try to, again, to the extent anybody cares what non-budget people think, tell them we think that's what we're hearing back home.
But I don't remember any discussion of what you're talking about, and we did just pass the two-year budget, so it's unlikely that would come up. This is just a readjustment session.
I understand.
You know, while the schools are certainly the biggest chunk of county funds in all of the localities, I mean, it's more than 50% of our county budget, and always is going to be. So it's a big elephant in the room, something we always have to pay attention to. But frankly, I think the legislature gets blasted with that all the time, and you're always paying attention to school stuff because education is always kind of one of the big things that bubbles up. I'm also worried about the smaller things that have a big impact locally, CSA, Region 10. The Children's Services Act, we need the flexibility in our local governments to be able to work on solutions locally that we cannot get reimbursed for now. Right now, if we put a solution in place, we try to treat kids in-house, we try to do something here locally, the dollars don't flow back to us. So it's really maybe a time savings for us. It may be nice to take care of our kids closer, but there's no financial incentive for us to do that. The only financial incentive is to send them out to somebody so we get two-thirds reimbursement from the state or from the Fed. When it comes to Region 10, Region 10 is always clamoring for support dollars to be able to handle the massive amount of mental health issues that are in our communities that have always been under addressed for the last 100 years. It's always been under the table. It's obviously a lot different in this environment now, but we need the ability to support them better. But those dollars come from these localities, and for CSA we have to have the ability to do things locally to be able to at least try it. We need a demonstration project, if nothing else, where a couple of localities can merge together. We have one supervisor that talks about it in the same way he talks about the regional jails. I don't know that we can necessarily get to that robust a facility, but we have to be able to do things in-house and get the reimbursement for it that we cannot get now. Otherwise, there's no incentive to try to do it less expensively and better for the families and the kids rather than sending them in car trips a long ways away.
I would echo those thoughts and encourage legislators to reevaluate how those CSA funds are being distributed. Mr. Nichols spoke about the two-thirds. In many cases, we're outsourcing education for our children. At 100%, we get two-thirds reimbursement from the county perspective via the state. And we could fund that service for those children, more than likely at the two-thirds, but we don't have those funds in-house. And if we fund that completely and it takes an additional staff member, we don't get any additional money for that. We have a program, I think many of you all are familiar with it, at Abrams, alternative education program, and it's become, I hate to use the word, but more robust thanks to the support of the locality and certainly the school board, and we're able to serve more and more students, those with disabilities, those that are in need of an alternative education program, but that costs money to make that happen. And when we can't serve them there, or they go through a program like FAP, CPMT, and they're outsourced via CSA funds, we could use those funds and serve those kids, and perhaps, not perhaps, I know, we could serve more kids for less dollars, but we can't get those dollars back to us. They have to be outsourced. And there are companies that are in business, and they're making money doing that. Sure. And I understand why.
And they have a lobby, and so we understand. Sure. We don't want to take away from private business, but the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission, David Blount, has his legislative package, as you'll see coming to all of you, that will be approved by the localities, has some significant language in there for CSA support. And so that will be a good place to source for the kinds of support that we're looking for, several different specific requests that are in that TJPDC legislative program that you'll see for this year.
Can you give us details at this time, or should we just wait till we see the package?
Well,
I don't mean the summary at the top. I mean, yep. Literally, what's the issue that's...
There's a copy of it. Like I was just saying, to address the two things really that Steve was pointing out, the flexibility piece in terms of being able to serve those kids locally as opposed to putting them on a bus and sitting 60 miles away. And then secondly, just having some state support for...
This may not be the forum, but... This is how we always seem to end up talking about CSAs, and everybody says that should be cheaper, better, and more local, but just the same level of care for the kids. And then when we get to Richmond, there's some trade-offs. You get more of this and less of that, as opposed to better, quicker, stronger, faster. It does maybe meet with you later or something. I mean,
we definitely can. I mean, we'd like to. This is not the other night when you were talking to the Levanna Leadership Development Program. One of the things you talked about is the kind of the devolution of inpatient support facilities for mental health care around the Commonwealth. We are talking a similar thing, trying to get care closer to home, but it's not that we don't know that that's a good thing. We just know that we cannot get paid for it now, so therefore there's we're helping families and students in a better way, but the money's not getting spent for that. It's not being redirected to that because we're not allowed legally to do that right now. So that's the change we need. We need the ability for localities to be part of the funding stream for CSA services. Because right now, we cannot, that funding stream for CSA services cannot pay for what we do.
This is the same. It doesn't help with what we do.
I understand.
And talk with us. We discussed this last year. CSA has been an issue since I started. And we were looking at a bill, and it informed that there was a study, and it was set off for a study group, and then I followed up recently, and to my knowledge, they have not met. So we held off last year. They told us there was a study group, they were going to meet, commission, whatever, and we haven't got anything.
So I got the announcement this morning from VACO that the head of CSA is now going to be holding some meetings and invite county administrators and other interested parties to come and talk, and it's related to this, so maybe there's something actually moving. But the legislature, I know that Louisa had proposed some legislation last year, and your office and others had taken it forward, yeah. And it didn't go anywhere, but it addressed the type of issue of us doing something locally.
It didn't go anywhere because they told us, let's go to this commission, we're going to create a panel, and they're going to work on it. And here we are, they're just now getting going.
Right.
So we will follow up. And we gave them this session and they didn't do anything. So if they hadn't come up with some suggestions, we'll move forward this session.
From a funding perspective, I don't know if you all are aware, they're looking at this, the state is looking at, via legislation, revamping the way we're serving. It doesn't have anything to do with CSA. Regional special education programs. There are a number of them around the state. We participate, Flavanna participates in one called PREP. It's our Piedmont Regional Educational Program. If that revamping actually occurs, I know we're going to lose some funding, possibly even seats in the way we're serving kids. works very similar. We have kids in need. We have four spots at a special program called Ivy Creek. So those kids that are in need, whether they, from an autistic standpoint, things like that, we're sending them out, and then there's a funding formula based on the composite index that's coming back to us, or via paying for those students and those seats there. I know there's some revamping. We've done the quick math on it. We could lose as much as about $200,000. We'll hope we're not to get hit as much with that. We heard 2 weeks ago that it was going to hit us in FY21, right?
Who's doing this?
It's coming out of the special ed department. I'm not sure where the legislative push is coming from. Do you know, did you get any names from that standpoint?
No. The General Assembly has been pushed to revamp the funding model for that because some school divisions are in regional programs and some are not. So there are some larger school divisions that are not, that are seeing it as inequitable.
Which I completely understand. But
they're taking the same pot and dividing it by 132 versus dividing it by 58 or whatever it is right now.
Right. And I just am worried about, from a small division, the impact that that will have on us as we're serving our kids. We send 22, 21 kids through regional-based programs, and it costs a lot of money. I mean, anywhere from Ivy Creek to Faison, which is, we work out of Richmond area. Just, if that comes across your desk, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to give us a call. Yes.
Yeah. I have some specific figures on how much CSA spends on this education component you were talking about. For last fiscal year, we served 15 kids at a cost of $900,000. Now, that's part of the cost. The other cost that doesn't get talked about, though, is called congregate education. These are the school services that are provided to children that are in a residential program. And what CSA is mandated to pay that also. That was an additional $423,000. Serving about 11 kids. So for 26 children, we spent approximately $1.3 million on this. That's approximately almost 50% of our budget that's spent here in the locality for CSA. So, something like this, it's not a small sum.
The numbers are high. Right. We serve CSA for about 100 or 180.
Currently, we serve approximately between 75 and 80 children. The number changes from quarter to quarter because some children leave, some people come in, but it stays pretty steady between 75 and 80.
All right, so I'm confused. What's the 15 and 11 versus the 75, right?
The 75 is the total. Roughly annual caseload of CSA, but out of that 75, there's about 15.
There are 15 children that we serve in these private schools. Because their needs are so high that the school kind of exceeds what the schools can provide at the time. Then we have another 11 children that are in residential programs for behavioral mental health issues. That we also provide fund their education services while they're in these programs. So it's totally 26 children. So it's roughly about a third of all the children that we serve on an annual basis.
But doing that in-house, we can't get, if the school system could somehow provide those services, mm-hmm. because they have the technical capability and the staff capability and the facilities to do that, we have to do it out of HIDE. Yeah. We can't get CSA reimbursement or funding for that. We can only get the funding if we send them out to a commercial place, to a private provider. Not if we do that same necessary care closer to home in our own school systems.
And that's what we're looking to do.
How many of those students do you think you could construct a program here, given that you'd have fewer economies of scale, but you would have less transportation, others?
We have. Approximately 400 special education students, 10 to 20 probably, and in severe needs that are being outsourced, maybe.
He's asking the CSA.
All the CSA kids.
Yeah, I'm just saying that there's 26 kids you have currently accessing these private, either residential or
day placement, right?
Yeah. And, I mean, there's some of
them. I'll go 25% of those kids, probably.
You think you could bring back in?
Yes, if we had the funding to fund we have the space. We could create the space via our programs and the staffing. It would be more the staffing and addressing some of their needs from an educational program as well.
and there is an avenue, there is a possible avenue for that. That could be a simple fix. So a few years ago, there was a change in the Children's Services Act, in the text of the actual CSA, that said that that CSA is not allowed to fund any programs or any services that occur during normal school hours. So any type of these programs could not be funded at that time. There is currently a little experiment going on around, I believe, the George Washington Planning District around the Fredericksburg, Spotsylvania area that is sort of reintroducing this, that sort of trying this concept out again to see if it, in fact, is something that could be, that could actually be expanded out to the entire state again. All it would need would just be a simple change in the legislation that states that CSAs can fund these types of programs. I think the concern that would be that would come up as a result of, or that would come up, would be how do we determine how effective these programs are when they are designed. There are a couple of little areas that have started doing things on their own that show varying degrees of success. Elmore County Public Schools has been doing, has this really interesting program they've been doing for several years now, as a great example. But there are certain things in motion that are looking at addressing this issue. But if we really want to get this funding back into the schools to design this program, making that simple rule change would be the most elegant solution to this.
What would be, so as the parent of a special needs kid, just to put it all on the table, there are certainly aspects of the, I don't want to keep you standing if it's more comfortable.
I sit all day,
okay, that's fine. So there are aspects of this interaction which are consensual, collegial, and there's aspects that are not. It's where the schools say we're doing enough, and the parents say, tried it for 3 years, it's not working at all. I don't know the answer to this. What would be the process? Who right now is in the CSA who decides? Is it, does the school have a, do you have a seat at the table for that? And the reason I'm asking is obvious, which would be, if you're sitting at the table and you're also saying this is good enough, and the parents say, no, it's not, now at least it's an outside-inside question.
Right.
If it's inside, all inside, it would be hard to reconcile.
Yes. Well,
there's a lot of competing interests, a lot of competing issues here. You don't want to make it all about money, but money inevitably plays a major role in what's available.
Right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe if you could address.
Yes, yeah, we do have a seat at the table, absolutely. We have a seat at the table. We have a seat at the planning, the beginning planning portion of that before we take a kid to FAP, before we take a kid to CPMT. Yes, but there's a lot of other players within that too. And a lot of outside folks that are pulling at that, wanting to, hey, we can offer those services. So it's not about money from a school system standpoint, but it is about money for those outside providers. And they're trying to look, and if they can get the ear of, we'll say, the parent, which shouldn't be happening, but if they can, you need to push for this, whether it be residential or whether it be a specialized program that we don't have the capabilities of offering, mainly because of funding. And because money, I didn't know.
That's perfectly fine. But to follow up on that, so when the school determines that they need some sort of private day placement, the school actually will sort of like do the research and legwork and say, we think this program is going to be the most ideal form for that. And that's really important because a lot of these schools have different types of philosophies, different types of program designs. Like what happens at the Institute of Autism is very different than what happens at the Faison Center, than what happens at North Star Academy. They all work differently. The challenge that comes up with this is that it's being able to determine which program is going to be most, it pairs up best with that child's unique outlook on life in general. There's a saying that in the developmentally disabled community, where when you meet one per child with autism, you've met a total of one child in that community. So they are so unique that that to say a one-size-fits-all program is not entirely accurate. Now, a specialized program in the schools could definitely bring some of the children back, and 25%, I don't think it's an unrealistic number.
But that's a tool in our tool bag. Right now, we have those different places to go to, and we have to pick and choose. What we want is we want the ability to have one more tool in our tool bag, and it may be the one that's closer to home. It may be better for the families just because the child's less away. It may be less resource intense. It may be just the right fit. It's definitely not going to be the right fit for every child because we're not going to do everything. But we want the ability to do that. Right now, We could do that. We could take it on, do a demonstration ourselves, but without any reimbursement that would have followed that child if we'd sent the child out. So that's
and really the reimbursement. Is that, and give us the language.
Right. And it'll be
and
in that.
Get the language to us, and let us make the proposal and see what we can do.
And the cost share currently is 2-1.
About 2-1.
Yes, right.
And we'll gladly be the, well, I don't want to speak for the school system. The county would gladly be the test dummy for this. We'll be the beta site. If you want to do a demonstration with a couple of counties, I know Louisa's gung-ho to do this. Savannah County would be delighted to work on this. School system, would you guys be interested?
Yeah, I just don't like the word dummy.
Yeah. And that's why we have a school system. That's just referring to me.
And David was telling us, Richard Stewart, Senator Stewart had some. And so everybody's aware of the problem. And the question is how to address it, fund it, and make sure the children's needs are best taken care of. So
well,
we're looking
the best part about this, we're not asking for new funding. We're asking for a change in the funding stream.
But it's redirected, but you have the families who want to go elsewhere.
Yep.
And so they're competing interests.
And that'll always be the case. But right now, it's a competing interest between I'm a private provider and I want the money to come to me and I don't want them to have the ability to use the money. Mm-hmm. But we're talking about the needs of the family and the child.
Yeah.
More so than the private industry or the schools.
I think there's also an irony, which is that the better job that the county does, the school system does in serving kids with special needs, the reputation increases, which means that we attract people that maybe have children with special needs, which then increases the cost to the county. And as you're aware, these costs can be very significant. One child could result in of a penny in the tax rate increase or half a penny in the tax rate increase, of which we have no control. The board doesn't get to say no to that. They get to say no to something else. And so there is a real bitter irony to doing a good job and actually serving some of our citizens that have the greatest needs. And I think that as has been highlighted, the state could do a little bit more to help even that out.
We will look at it.
So we've hit CSA hard. What's next?
Mr. Winkler, did you have anything else?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. I'd like to address and just request your help continuing with SOQ mandates that are often come down to us, but there's not funds associated with them. An example might be, since we've been talking about mental health, the increase in guidance counselors across the board. If there's an increase for guidance counselors, let's say it goes to 1 to 250, I think it's 1 to 500 now. Depending on the level, if we go to that, that would be wonderful for our school system because the mental health need continues to increase pre-K, 12, and even post that, but not if it's a trade-off for another type of position, a librarian's a CTE position. If the funding is there or the mandate is made to increase the funding within the SOQs, right now we have approximately 500 employees, a little bit over that, and of that, a little shy of 300 are SOQ-based positions. So the locality is picking up 200 additional employees to help our students. So just please be cognizant of that. Other mandates that are coming down and or House bills, I believe it was House Bill 1600. I know Senate Bill 170 spoke to suspensions. And I appreciate the work that was done on that and the revamping of that. I really do. Because it didn't necessarily tie our hands, particularly with our younger kids. I do greatly appreciate the bill, but whenever there's a suspension bill, we're talking about kids and how to treat kids, please trust the educators to do their job. I know you do, and I greatly appreciate that work. Any thoughts, processes on what I just now said there?
We're very aware of unfunded mandates.
Yes, sir.
We're trying to avoid those. It's one of the first things we look at. And I know we're talking about SOQ positions.
Sure.
For mental health and for school resource officers.
Yes, sir.
I will do my best to make sure if we're going to put the mandate on you that it's covered.
I'm not on
finance.
Are there more than 200 non-SOQ positions, or are we thinking of them differently? In other words, we always use the Chinese teacher. So Fairfax has enough money that even beyond SOQ positions, they said we want to teach Mandarin Chinese. It's not an SOQ position, but they just pay for it locally. That's mostly for the localities that are above 50% or above 75% on the SOQs.
Yes.
What's not being covered by the SOQs that you're covering such that 40% of your people are not SOQ positions?
That's
a lot.
Yeah, they're
that's a lot.
The superintendent's position.
part of the superintendent position.
Class sizes.
The board has made a commitment to keep the class sizes smaller, particularly from a K-3 level.
Okay.
We have some CTE positions, not a lot. We're fortunate to get some funding via CTE. Our PE class sizes, there's a funding formula in there, says you have to offer basic resources or exploratory type of positions, but those type of things. Instructional assistants are a big one. From an SOQ standpoint, we have 70 to 75 instructional assistants in the county. I would venture to say not more than 10 of them are based on, from an SOQ standpoint.
So the SOQs are supposed to provide the baseline. It's important for a place like the Fluvanna.
The minimum. The baseline minimum.
Well, I understand. What I'm saying, though, the difference is then any dollars you get from the state funnel through the formulas, Fluvanna gets essentially 2-for-1 because you're 37.
Yes.
The other thing that happens is they take like the enrollment of the high school, which is 1,400, and then you divide that and go, well, we want a class size of 25-to-1, and we come up with a number there.
Right.
But it doesn't work that way in reality. In reality, you have to have a teacher that's licensed to teach biology. You have to have a teacher that's licensed to teach chemistry. Those classes may be those sizes, they may be different sizes, but you have to be able to provide that.
Right, we're 21-to-1 in English as a second grade.
It's not, you can't just use a straight formula to come up with these guidelines. It just doesn't work that way in reality.
Right. Kindergarten, if you go over 25, you have to have an instructional assistant. We don't have any classes over 25. I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of the board's support with that. However, it doesn't mean because you have 18 kids in that classroom, you don't need an extra set of hands for 5-year-old, you know, for 18 5-year-old babies coming at you. You do. So we try to provide that. Those are some examples of that.
Working my way down on the counselor issue, there's two things that are being discussed. The first would be simply changing the ratio. The second would be the counselors have told us that even if there are enough counselors, they are being dragged 100 different ways.
That's correct.
Beyond mental health. If we want to make it a mental health position, we need to stop working so hard on.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. They all said, this is a good idea. Sure. Somebody should do this. I give the Skittles to the birthday person each day.
Mm-hmm.
They like that. It's good for morale. It gives them a look. But that's taking time out of my core function, even things like college. Talking to kids about academics outside the mental health arena is taking away from their ability to say, Johnny's really struggling. Something's really going on at home. I don't need one day a month with him. I need to bring him in every lunch period for a few weeks and figure out what's going on. So that would be the other thing that would end impacts. I mean, in other words, the job that they're doing for the people would have to be taken up by somebody else, or you'd have to hire somebody else to do it. So it ends up affecting your manpower no matter what.
And kudos, and I greatly appreciate the work that has been done to help out with the teacher shortage. That I'm attending a summit in just a couple of weeks in Charlottesville to discuss this even further. The extension of the 10-year license, it hasn't gone into effect yet, so I don't know what that's going to look and how that's going to look like from a recertification point. Currently, it was 5 years in the past, so you need 180 recertification point. I'm working under the assumption it will be 10 years and 360, but we're waiting to get some guidelines from DOE on that. Greatly appreciate the support from the extension of provisional license. The thing that I would like to ask for, particularly in the CTE realm, is the opportunity for superintendent's waivers to come back on that, to license these teachers, at least for a 5-year program, until we can get them a license, if that makes sense.
Who's fighting against that?
I'm not sure who's fighting against that. I know who's fighting for it.
It's just really hard to find CTE people who are knowledgeable in the field that want to leave for the amount of money that they get paid as a teacher. I mean, and that's kind of the bigger issue. A lot of the bills that came up last year were dealing with teacher prep programs and funding money into post-secondary ed, and I get all of that. I understand that, I support that. However, the bigger issue is people aren't going into education because they can make more money in the private sector, and we have to be able to offset that with some data.
Unless my board members have anything else that they want to discuss from Ms. Gillum, I greatly appreciate your time and listening, and I'm sure they'll have some topics that I might want to chime in on from the school perspective.
But you mentioned CTE. What are there any particular challenges there?
Health and medical,
yes.
that's the biggest one.
Yeah, and funding those programs, the large-scale programs, I guess one of my dreams would be to bring in something from an auto mechanic standpoint, and I'd love to be able to model it after Louisa, and Mr. Traley and Louisa's done a wonderful job with that as well as his folks, but having the funding to offset availability of grants to, because I can afford the teacher at, our teachers don't get paid $80,000, but with Benny's, that's about what you budget for a teacher somewhere in the middle. It's around $80,000 with benefits included. But that program's going to cost us in excess of probably $1 million to set up just a startup. Once you get rolling, that's a one-time cost. We can make that happen. Just availability of that.
That's auto mechanic.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
One thing, y'all started the, I believe it's EMT class now?
Yes.
So hopefully that will help us down the road and volunteers and possibly professionals be able to help out.
Right, it took us all summer to find an EMT teacher. I mean, we were in September before we actually got somebody. And looking at her past salary history, I don't know if we'll be able to keep her.
Right. But even the folks that were applying may have taught EMT, may have, you know, been an EMT for years. If I had the autonomy to request a waiver, mm-hmm. said, hey, give us 5 years, let's get if nothing else provisional, and we can work on that. The state has, DOE, the State Department has loosened the licensure requirements and given local boards and local superintendents the autonomy to provide its 5 curriculum-based classes. We can provide those classes in-house, we just have to have the instructor for that. And I'm appreciative of that as well, but it's a pretty extensive waiver process to do. I'd like to bypass some of those curriculum classes because these folks are out in there doing the trades, and that's what we're hiring them to do. If they can teach that, that's what I need them to be able to do. I'll work on the curriculum aspect later.
Is it the literacy test that's the main obstacle?
Yeah, well, the VCLA is a obstacle for them, but it's also the 5 curriculum courses that they're having to be required to take as well.
And are y'all any of the CTE programs with Piedmont?
We have in the past, but I'll, yeah.
We do some things with Piedmont. The issue with Piedmont is some of the teachers have to have a master's for a lot of the Piedmont for the transferable credits. And so that's another issue, is if they don't have that master's in the content area, then it can be a non-transferable credit, but not a transferable credit. So you do have to kind of be a little careful with that. But we have our nurse aid program is dual enrolled, and we have 100% pass rate, but there can only be 10 kids in that class when they do clinicals. We know we have a nursing shortage, but we also have a nursing teacher shortage. So it's the whole thing just kind of compounds on itself. And I want good nurses when I go to the nursing home.
That's soon.
When you get to the nursing home?
I'm sorry?
When you get to the nursing home, there aren't any nurses in a nursing
home. Yeah, I know.
just CNAs. Assistants in the world. All right.
Alrighty.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Winkler. Sheriff Hess?
Yes. First of all, thank you all for coming today and participating in this program. Our formal conference with the sheriffs was canceled this year due to the hurricane, and it was, that was terrible news because we had a lot of things to cover. A couple of things I'd like to discuss with y'all are part of what we were going to talk about at the conference. And these are generally for your information. I know last year we talked about concealed handgun permits, extending the life on those to maybe 10 years. This year we've run into some issues with the state police, or they're almost a year behind putting them in the system. We've had people get arrested for having not being in compliance when they were. The information did not get into the VSIN. So we had one gentleman that was arrested twice. He got a felony. And we're going to have to expunge that because the information was not put into the system.
About state police.
State police, yes, not the clerk's office. Yeah. I was able to fix the problem by calling them. Yeah. They had the information, it just was not in VSIN.
Right. What did they say why?
They're behind. It's backlog. And there's supposed to be an interface so that when we put the information in, there's supposed to be an interface. We started last November
providing all the information so that the interface, when it opened, all of the information would transfer to the state police. And they have not been able to get their end of IT ready for the interface. So we can't even help them out by providing the information through the interface. So
the state police, they're the keeper of the system. But basically, the way the system works, they come to the clerk's office, pay their fee, do their application. They come to my office, we do their criminal history, we do that. Then it goes to the Commonwealth Attorney's office to be signed off on and back to the clerk.
And we listened to you last year. We carried a bill to extend it to 10 years, and then they referred it to finance to see if we're going to lose any money from it. And so we're waiting
to everybody I've talked to said they'll pay twice.
If it's
$5 I'll pay $100
for not having to come back.
And cut down on the workload too and make it more efficient. And there the process is in place. If you do something wrong, they recall that permit from us.
Yep. So we listened. Yes. Put it forward and they sent it off into finance and to study it.
Just don't leave that topic. So you've issued the actual, okay, so they have it in a wallet if they have it. It's just not on Visa? Is that the?
Who's charging them?
Who's charging them?
You said a guy got charged
anywhere,
once.
Anywhere they go, if it's not there.
Was it state police or the deputy?
I imagine there have been people throughout the state that have been charged, but we've charged two people.
You said you got somebody who got charged twice and had a felony. Was he charged here in Fluvanna?
Yes.
So your deputies or was it state police?
Yes. And if it's not in the system, it's not legitimate.
The card doesn't count.
You can forge cards. Just like you can forge the decal. We have a lot of those where on the state registration, people are forging those things all the time. And it just, we're going to try to do a better job of maintaining that in-house. And we've sent information out to the deputies now to follow up with the clerks and not charge, and then come back and charge them after we find out if there's an issue. And we fixed that gap. But when you're still almost a year behind that, you know, if they're out, what if they're in another county or another state?
That's
what I'm really, really worried about that part.
You're giving them, it's actually worse than nothing, because they get a double. When you get the card, they say, here's your card, and you go. So you actually assume it's in good order.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's worse than saying, well, when the state police get back to you and send you a postcard, that's when it really has.
That's right. It's just like telling somebody, oh, I've never been arrested. Well, NCIC says you have.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be consistent and go with what you have.
We'll check with the state police.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. If you all participated in the grant funding for the SROs, that was valuable to every jurisdiction, and that will give us our third SRO here in the community, which security in our schools is a top priority. A couple other things. We talk about teacher shortages. When you go through your jurisdictions, ask your sheriffs and your police chiefs if they're 100% staffed.
We don't have to ask.
Yeah. So with us, it's a generational thing. The younger generation, they don't want to work weekends. They don't want to work holidays. And with a lot of negativity in the media, a lot of people say, well, that's just not for me. But as in our leadership conference, there was a four-hour block this year about how to retain people and the generational things that are causing these issues. So that was rather interesting. Another thing that we've talked about is procurement. If there's any way y'all have any input for the state procurement contracts, I think they can do way better. This year, we did not buy our vehicles from the state contract. We bought it through the Virginia Sheriff's Institute and saved money. Several jurisdictions around us are buying through them. There are so many things on the state contract, but I think somebody could do a whole lot better job of getting the equipment that we need, whether it's lights for our cars that we buy. It's just an example, the shoes I have on today cost me $99. Last year, my shoes cost me $36 because I found them on eBay. So we always look at alternative sources, but they're not always there. So, you know, I think we can do a little bit better job of buying in bulk.
Whenever we bring this up with people, and this is a regular issue, they say just eBay, and eBay's a good example. eBay's not the best example because in theory that's a unique pair of shoes that somebody in Seattle stopped using. But if you have a vendor who has an identical product, that is $14 cheaper than the state is getting, because the state supposedly is getting the benefits of the economies of scale. I mean, I guess what I, could you, if you find one, could you send me a couple of examples and we can bump that up the chain? Because I think that actually, they always say, as I prove it, but they say, give me an example. And you go, well, the sheriff says he can find stuff cheaper. And they go, we're happy to do that, but we need to see it so we can see if there's just a better vendor for us.
Exactly.
Obviously, the whole point of it is to save money, not the other way around. You're not the first person who has complained about it.
Yes, simple thing, they're putting the mandates, and that's where I've watched this turn around, and I've discussed this with Eric Dahl, our finance director, just a little while ago, but everybody's putting 5-year limits on everything. It's like, okay, this taser, which costs 3 times what this firearm does, guess what, we're not going to certify it after 5 years, so if you get in a lawsuit, we're going to tell them, well, you know, we're not responsible for the voltage and that thing and all this stuff, so here you are, you're forced to throw that in the trash can and purchase another one. You know, and that's turning into an industry for light bars. We're not going to guarantee that light bar. You know, we're not going to do this. We're not
going to
do that.
Is the certification coming from the vendor or from
ACGS
or something?
Specifically, exactly. There, bulletproof vests. You have to get them every 3 years because, you know, they say after 3 years we're not going to say that they're any good.
But that's vendors
right.
Saying that.
So what it's doing is and there's not much we can do about that. I'm telling you that because that's an added cost to whoever's paying for that equipment. Now,
well,
instead of making a taser last 6 or 7 years, yeah. I know that now I got to have X number of tasers.
Could you? So that would be another one where they're going to say, give me an example. Could you, when you go back to the office sometime in the next couple of weeks, in addition to the, hey, I can find the light bar for $136 less, if there's something where the, the sunset has changed. So I assume there actually is a point where the taser is no longer usable. But if it has changed from 10 to 7 to 5, now they're saying 3, for frankly better technology, that would be something I think we would want the procurement people to look at, because what they're doing is driving the sales like you're talking about. And maybe 3 is actually the right number. Maybe over time they've realized that at the 4th year it actually starts to degrade. But if not, if it's the same thing, we need a different vendor. We need a vendor who will in fact certify through 5 or 7.
That's right. And we can put the pressure on. All right, if you're not going to certify it for 5 years, we're not going to get it from you. And say that with bulletproof vests, I guess bullets are getting more powerful, so you might have to update, but if it hadn't been shot up, it's probably as good as it was 5 or 6. So that's where we need to know, and procurement. All right, Mr. Vendor, if you're going to cut it from 5 to 3, we're going to go somewhere else who will give it to us for 5 or 6. And y'all are buying, so we should not be letting the vendors
dictate
when you have to renew and what you have to do. We've
exactly.
Got
to use the taser issue. Taser's a bad example.
Taser issue. Taser's a manufacturer product. They hold pretty much a monopoly on it because there's no competitor to the taser, if y'all are familiar with it. They sue everybody that tries to gain close to patent infringement. They actually came out and said after 5 years, we will certify the technology in it. So if we tase somebody, which is the improper term, but it's a term everybody knows, we deploy the taser on somebody and they try to claim there's a voltage spike or something that causes an issue. Taser's going to say, we told you it's not good after 5 years. And there is no other manufacturer getting the like products. So taser's the key example of that one. The other stuff is like the video camera systems. They only offer 5-year warranty. A lot of it's just technology and planned obsolescence we just have to deal with because it's mostly the manufacturers doing it.
So some things we can maybe hold vendors to. Taser's a bad example because they've got a monopoly on a product. Vehicles are another thing we're seeing. This just give you more of a heads up that we can't do anything with the manufacturers, but they keep changing the vehicles and the prices are steadily going up. An example would be the Ford SUV that we currently have. We paid, 27, 28 for them. They're being retrofitted next year and they're going to come in about 34, 35. So, you know, it's always, and then they're going to limit you to what you can have, and Charger is probably going to be one of the last sedans that you'll see in police vehicles, and they've been consistent and for a small locality like us, we can, if they don't change the body style, we can use that equipment until they tell us it's not any good anymore. But if you can get it in and out of a car, Crown Vic, you can use the center console 5 times in a Crown Vic because they didn't change it. You know, but now everything in the industry changes, the prices go up. So it inevitably it comes back to the counties, and it puts a burden especially on smaller agencies. And it's just, that's the kind of message I wanted y'all to hear, was that these costs are going up, as well as the ability to find qualified people who want to come into this profession. The two things that I'd ask you also, anytime you can have any input, our biggest problems are opioid-related and mental health. Those are the two biggest upticks in everything we do. Our mental health, what we do about 2 a week almost. A lot of children in these, it's a sad situation. They need help. And the more beds we can get closer, the better we can get people to facilities. And with a small agency like we are, nobody can make a mental health transport that's working. You got to call somebody in that's off duty because they could be gone for 6-7 hours. So it's always a burden on the agency. People need help to fix their issues. Whatever input you all have in those two areas, the opioids, if they're like we're big settlements for the tobacco industry. If there are settlements in the future for the opioid industry, I would ask you to put that back into treatment for those people that are addicted to those drugs. We're trying to start a drug court here in our community. In a rural community, we're running into all the obstacles that the other jurisdictions are running into. We don't have an infrastructure for transportation. Most people that are addicted to heroin or whatever, they probably don't have a driver's license. So how are they going to get to Region 10 in Charlottesville and go through the treatment that they need there? How are they going to go for their drug testing? How are they going to get the drug court? So we're working as a group with the Commonwealth Attorney, Clerk of the Court, judges, and we're trying to make something work for our community. But inevitably, it's going to come back to us having to come to the county and say we need money to make this work. And everybody knows that that's a tight thing everywhere. But we can't arrest our way out of that crisis. We have to give people help. So that's all I have.
You said you're transporting 2 a week. Are those TDOs? And you say you're transporting.
Oh, we have the ECOs, which we do have a contract with UVA.
Okay. I was going to ask where they go.
We can take an ECO over there.
Right.
If they have the staffing, which last year we probably gave back more than half of the money because they never have the staffing, we wind up sitting there with two deputies until they're evaluated, which we know can take sometimes a long time. And then if they don't have a bed there, then we get the TDO. Then now we're driving, you know, to
where?
Wherever they can find something.
Do you have a place that's sort of the default? Where's the single place you send the most people?
Closest place is Western State for us. We took one there yesterday. One from that was overnight at UVA, and then the next day they decided for some reason to move that individual. And we, at the end of the day, we had to move that individual. We've gone as far as down Southwest Virginia to Abington to deliver one. And then they're down there saying, "Well, oh, y'all took our bed. Now if we have one, we're probably driving up to you."
And Senator Jericho's been on the leading edge of this because, you know, Deep Southwest, they're bringing over here. They got a deputy gone for a day and a half.
Wow.
And so we are aware of it. Trying to address it.
Exactly. And anything you can do to help the localities as well as the citizens that really, really need that help. It's a tough thing to be addicted to those various drugs, and the number of fatalities we've had are steadily on an increase. But thank you.
All righty. Thanks, Sheriff. Next, we'll go to Zion's Crossroads Economic Development Opportunities and Partnerships Update. Mr. Nichols.
So, good news yesterday. We got the bids back for our Zion Crossroads Water and Sewer Project. And I've been preaching bad news to my board for the last few months because we expected, with the cost of construction going up and tariffs and steel costs and everything, that we'd have astronomical bids. The bids came in $1 million less than what we had programmed for the construction part. So we're very thankful, but that means that sometime in the next 60 to 90 days, we'll have shovels in the ground. In the next year and a half, we'll have a fully functioning water and sewer system all along the Zion Crossroads corridor in our county. That means economic development is first and foremost in forefront of Fluvanna County, We are partnering with the Central Virginia Partnership for Economic Development, with VITA, our economic developers working with all different kinds of agencies and sources. But what we want to make sure that you remember is whenever you hear about something that may be beneficial to a locality that is small rural locality that needs assistance for economic development, keep us in mind. It's decades in the making. Savannah's been talking about this for 30 or 40 years, and this board has gotten this accomplished. We've gotten the bids back now. We're ready to award the contracts, and it's a significant time. But anything you think that you hear from that your staff or you hear about economic development support ideas, we'd be very, very interested in. We'll certainly stay in touch with you if we have ideas or we hear about something. We also are going to have a briefing here fairly soon from Louisa County. They are working on a regional business park, and we're going to have them brief our board. Our board's been talking about this for a few weeks. That regional business park could be a huge boon for Central Virginia. 1,600 acres worth of light industry and development and jobs in Central Virginia would be amazing. There are not too many, I don't like to say a lot, but mega sites in the Commonwealth. People get kind of upset about that. But this could be one of them just up the street in Louisa County, but it would be a regional partnership. Anything you can do to keep that in mind to support that effort is great for all the constituents you have in Central Virginia, because it's going to be a job feeder and a collaborator with all of our industries.
So I was looking around. I think with the exception of Mel, I've been here the longest. Mm-hmm. If we, they're not being funny here, so.
Mr. Weaver's saying, not here, so.
What you're saying is, I know, I saw down this side. A year and a half from today, you expect to have the sewer and the water
yes.
in. And then if somebody says, yes, it's not a and then,
yep.
it's there. Okay.
We are, the bids are done. We've
right.
opened them. All we're doing is waiting to award the contract on the board's agenda formally.
Okay.
That'll happen in the next 30 days or so.
Okay, so then the question would be, give us some thoughts on what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. We will. And we'll put together a specific list of things so that you and your staff will know the types of things we're looking for, the kinds of aims we're looking for.
Do you have some general?
Well,
are you looking for light industry? Are you looking for big retail? Are you hoping to have a Sheets that competes with Sheets across 60? Tell us what we do.
Specifically, we want some mixed use developments
okay.
where you have maybe small retail or things on the first on the lower levels, but then maybe some residential above that, because it's going to feed to Charlottesville. The 250 corridor is going to grow all the way out to Zion Crossroads. We also are looking at big box stores. There is no target in between Charlottesville and Richmond. There is no Home Depot between Waynesboro and Short Pump, and they almost always build together. So we've got the perfect place for it, a Lowe's on one side of there. So we're going after box stores, but we also are looking for the small manufacturers. We've got an auto recycling parts manufacturer we're trying to land that has been challenging to do that, but they're specifically here because it was a piece of property that was going to be covered by water and sewer. And because we have good land value still, that's why they came to us.
And when you mentioned the 16-acre the 1,600-acre region of the site,
mm-hmm.
that is still every inch in Louisa, though. Right.
Yes, it is. Oh, that, actually, there's a smidge, I think, in Goochland County, just a smidge that goes over the line. But it is clearly in Louisa County, but it is meant to be, their intention is to have it be a regional business park, where, for instance, let's say it takes $100 million to get this kicked off and buy the land and get the infrastructure in. If a county puts in $10 million for it, then they got 10% interest stake, and they get tax revenue out of that, too. So it'll end up being an authority eventually, but the documents will be written specifically on whatever you're buying is you will share in the tax revenue.
So that
it doesn't have to
the
be
question.
Just in
They're
one
not,
county.
It's not something simply competing with your new.
Absolutely not. It is. It's the rising tide floats all boats, because it'll be jobs for our folks, because it'll be industry support, maybe industries we already have, because it can be complementary. It is a great way to land some of those big things that we wouldn't mind in our communities, but share in the revenue from that, because the revenue doesn't go to just one county if it's a regional business park where we share it.
But added to that is the fact that the county has to have the investment to be able to make, to contribute to that program. For Savannah County, we come up with $10 million right now. to participate in that program to get 10% requires a board approval. Of course, you know, that requires looking down the road, because really that's a 2025 year program. And it sort of highlights the differences, in my opinion, in terms of what, and for lack of a better word, I don't want to say a healthy county, because I think Louisa County is very healthy, but what a county that, such as Louisa, which has benefited from some smart investments, some smart decisions, but certainly from their nuclear power plants, what kind of things a county along Virginia's main corridors can do, and how counties that are not able to capitalize on nuclear power plants, you know, lag behind. Yes, we rise with the tide, but we certainly trail behind it from that standpoint. And to that, and I think, you know, the programs that are being done in Richmond, such as Go Virginia, are very helpful, and I would certainly encourage you to continue to fund that, maybe loosen some of the restrictions on how Go Virginia allocates its money, but I think those are great programs that can really help. And so I know money has been tight in Richmond, but economic development is really crucial, especially as we look to diversify outside of the military. Great that we're, you know, releasing sequestration and putting some more money into the military. That's fine, except we're, you know, going to end up in the same boat when that strait tightens back up. So this is a good opportunity in Richmond to take benefit of the growth that's happening and help distribute that to other counties that will grow.
One of the ways to keep business coming here and to give alternatives and options is our kind of overlay zones. Jason Stewart, our community development director and planning and zoning administrator, can talk a little bit briefly about that. It just makes it much easier for people that want to do something in the land to be prepared to do that. So, Jason?
We have a lot of family-owned properties up there, and oftentimes the impediment to bringing business in is those folks don't want to rezone and pay that taxation because they're in the land use taxation program. We found that Hanover County had a good program they call the Strategic Zoning Initiative, where they held off on taxing the property as commercial until there's a certificate of occupancy, which would allow them to market the property, rezone the property to commercial, but still maintain their agricultural character of the property and the taxation value. Mr. Sheridan can explain the ins and outs of the land use taxation program as it relates to that. But we implemented that program this past year, and we feel it would be a good incentive for folks to market their property and kind of speed things along with the board.
And when the use changes, then the taxation changes. So,
y'all are able to do that now without any action from us, correct?
That's been done, right.
I would just say, y'all need to keep us apprised, because so far, Lowe's, Home Depot, they've never called me to say, hey, I'm thinking about putting a place here, if you got any place in mind. So y'all need to know, let us know. And if you're talking to this auto, I'd love to come in and, you know, well, we can help out if VDOT's dragging their feet or what they're going to have to do to make a road or something like that. If some state agency is dragging their feet and needs to get a response, that's where we can put the pressure and make the calls and make sure they respond as quickly as they can. Or if you have somebody coming in, happy to meet with them and let them know, yes, we will be as business friendly as we can. We would love to have you in this area, this county, this region, and we'll do what we can to help you grow. But you know, they don't call us,
right,
and say, hey, we're looking for a spot. So you guys have to let us know.
Unfortunately,
unless they might call Rob, they don't call me.
With LKQ, the problem is NIMBYs. So it's in court.
Well, and that's part of y'all's zoning problems. Not much we can do on the state level with that as well.
Steve, so you all have cleared the preservation of antiquities?
Yeah, for the Zion Crossroads Water and Sewer Project, we are completely permit ready and ready to dig tomorrow.
Because that was budget language, I believe, went through last year that directed them to come up with ways to streamline their program, because of so many complaints about how long it was taking.
Well, we fortunately, the Zion Crossroads corridor, the 250 corridor along Route 64, it has no waterways nearby, so it's not necessarily the place where people, you know, in our ancestors and Native Americans lived, because it's not along a waterway. We have significant problems with our James River Water Authority project that is shared with Louisa County, because that one is completely beholden to the last down to the last tack of Department of
Human Resources. That one is still being held up.
That one is. We have another meeting to that. It could be in Richmond at 1 o'clock for another meeting with Department of Historic Resources and Corps of Engineers. That one, we've gotten every permit done, and for the last year and a half, we've been waiting on the Corps of Engineers permit. We have been complaining to federal legislators about that as well. But our Zion Crossroads Water and Sewer Project has been a really good collaboration, and in collaboration with the Department of Corrections from the Commonwealth, because we're going to share water and sewer sources there. They will eventually be a customer of ours, because the Mechunk Creek, where they draw from, won't be the viable water source long term. But we've talked about that for decades, and so we'll be partnering with that state agency. We already have agreements with the state agency to use their excess water and sewer capacity on the front end.
All righty. Now we'll move forward with broadband. And let's see.
I'll tell you what's going on, and then Mr. Sheridan can do the ask, because he's good at the ask on this. We have partnered with Central Virginia Electric Cooperative. Our county, more so than any county in locality under Central Virginia's area of service, we have the highest number of customers for any county that they have. It covers almost 80, or a little over 80% of our households in the county. So broadband expansion into a rural county is an incredibly important opportunity for us, for schools, for business, for daily life. The board has agreed to put some cash forward and some tax incentives forward to that. But now we've still got, if you've got a big square for Flavanna County, the southeast corner of that is empty. There's nothing there because it's not the Fork Union District, because it's not a Central Virginia Electric Cooperative. Dominion was required last year to do a report. The legislature required to turn in by December 31st of this year to say how they may or may not be able to play in broadband in the community. If nothing else, even if Dominion never says they want to be a broadband provider, we've got to find a way to let other people that want to be broadband providers put fiber on their poles. And that means there has to be some agreements on my electrician to be able to work near your electrified line. And I'm hoping that the legislatures can squeeze Dominion to be as collegial and collaborative on that as possible, because it's one of the only ways we're going to get fiber into a non-served area. And so our board really needs some support.
Well, the private industry doesn't want to go there because it is one of the more rural areas of our county, so they don't have enough customers to make it worth their while. And Mr. Winkler, help me out here. How many of our schools are served by Dominion?
All of them except for one.
So three of our schools are served on the Dominion line. So it's just, if y'all can help find some way, and I know that that's the big push now is broadband. And we are doing our best to get it to every citizen in our county and make it as financially feasible as possible. But that last section is going to, we're going to need help on. And so that's the biggest thing I can tell you, is to get it to our southeast corner, the Fork Union District.
And that means those providers that don't want to be broadband providers need to be collegial enough to allow someone to put broadband into their area. And the cheapest way to do that is on the poles. Not putting fiber underground, and maybe there may be microwave or wireless, but getting fiber on the poles is one of the cheapest ways.
The co-location of the wires, if you will, has been an ongoing topic, and just it's a who controls it, who repairs it, what if there's damage, and what's the money?
Right.
That was just Chad.
Yeah. McDougal had one in Senate, and that's more localities who can put stuff on their poles.
If you could, this is another place where just a vague ask doesn't do anybody any good.
Right.
If you could give me a map, show me where it is, mm-hmm. and then that's something mm-hmm. we can take directly to Dominion and say, oh, there's some hurdles or hiccups.
Because we're going to have, CVEC is going to have their equipment people here. I mean, and to just keep going straight on down the line would not be that big of a hassle for them.
So we get that study December 31st, and then we'll start. But just governor's on it. Everybody's talking about
it. In the meantime, we'll send you what we look like and where our holes are, just so you're aware of that, because that will, it would be a significant boon to our county if the people that have the least services in our county actually got paid attention to it.
And as a supervisor, you know, I fear with my constituents that we're going to be so divided. We're going to have a group of people, the haves, and we're going to have nots. And you get people discouraged, and we need to keep them in mind, and we need to keep pushing. Every time we talk about broadband, we need to talk about the ways in which we're trying to accommodate all citizens in Fluvanna County. We cannot let down on that.
And that means, and that's mainly Mr. Ware's district, because it's my district is the same way. The two sections of the county that are the most rural are Ms. Booker's and I's districts. That's why we take up about 60% of the county between the two of us. But, you know, just any way we can get it there, because the other area is going to be Columbia, the Columbia area, just because of the lack of population, lack of density.
I doubt that the line follows neatly along.
They're all over. If you look, I mean,
when you give us a map,
our voting districts, but also the coverage areas.
You got this little program right here, okay? Go to the back page and flip the back page over. It's what's going on in Fluvanna County. Flip the back page over and then look on the opposite side of it. You'll see right there around the county, CVEC serves about 85% of the county, and it gives you a map. Now, it's really hard to see the Ferncliff area.
Slide seven.
I see the seven down there. Go up. Yep. And you can see the southeastern corner that I'm talking about. But it's really crazy how they run, because the area that serves Lake Monticello also comes out and serves a branch. One branch runs all the way out in near Ken Store. They're all over the place, and he's got them color-coded.
But those lines are the CVEC lines. That's where they're going to put fiber. They're going to cover.
But that shows you where we're not getting it.
Yeah.
And the yellow up there and the green will be tough. Okay. All righty. And in essence of time, let me real quick, are there any agency heads that have anything that they want to bring up?
Yes.
How did I know that?
We're sitting down here for a reason.
Yes, sir, Mr. Jerry.
Two things. I'll make it as quickly as I can. I'm not sure. I want to just say thank you to the General Assembly that's members that are here for your support with their redevelopment funding. Y'all have been very supportive in the past. It's not everything that all of the constitutional officers of associations asked for, but it's been very helpful with respect to the master deputy programs for treasurer, master deputy sheriff, master deputy commissioner of revenue, and clerk, and career prosecutor. So it's been very helpful. We're willing to put in the work and go to school and get certified, and the General Assembly's helped us in fun. So just thank you for that. We'll come back, of course, like everybody else, and ask for a little bit more, but we appreciate what we got and very helpful. The other thing is a pretty darn big, issue is the voting precinct issue. And I know if many people in the room are not going to be aware of it, but there's a whole lot of folks in this room that the positions they have depend upon where the residency is, And what it really boils down to is that Senator Peacock, I think, that helped primarily with Mr. Goodman, has helped Fluvanna and Louisa try to come up with some resolution. But it's a resolution for the current issue, which is the federal precincts as we approach the next congressional election, and the direction from Richmond, for General Register, Ms. Pace, of course, is here, and they can speak to it eloquently. But the long story short is, your help has helped us try to fix this problem that we have, the immediate problem of voters that are being told to vote in one district and pay the taxes in another. We know the issue, and we think we've got to fix it. We're working with Louisa that will fix it for the immediate future, but it is a much longer term problem. And Lord, when we get the General Assembly direction for voter registration, who's on which side of which line, the bigger issue, not unique to Fluvanna and Louisa, certainly Louisa and Goochland have it, we have it at Chalamet. It's real nice and clean when you got something like the James River. real issue is a modern county boundary that you can have some confidence in. Right now, we are aware of at least four different county boundaries with Fremont and Louisa. What we think is a boundary, what Louisa thinks is a boundary, what VDOT thinks is a boundary, what the Department of Elections in Richmond thinks is a boundary. And of course, they operate with blinders on and say you have to comply with what this guidance is. And it's not that clean when you guys have paid taxes for decades in one county and now they're told to vote in another. So hopefully we'll be able to fix it temporarily. If you're not familiar with the issue, just ask George. She'll be able to tell you all about it. But just imagine that you got a letter and you said you're no longer going to be voting in Louisiana or in Louisa, or you're not voting in the office of the precinct if you happen to be on the line. So I don't know how the General Assembly can get his hands around modern county boundaries. That's going to be a really expensive, large issue, but until that's done, it's going to be a continual problem if it works like that. And most of our surveys for counties were done by horseback, you know, literally. Somebody can say, oh, I got a new one the GIS just gave us. But the disclaimer on every GIS website is, don't take this for accuracy. You know, it's not accurate. It can't be used in court of law for, it's the best that we can come up with for what we have. And as the precinct boundaries are directed from Richmond associated with General Assembly elections, it just make this issue more complicated. But thank you for helping us resolve it for the congressional elections. Some paper office, I think, it's got some legislation. We think we met with Louisa, I know Mr. Nichols is bringing. We think it will fix it for the immediate future, but it's not fixing it long term. Those are where we have some significant issues.
We really appreciate Mr. Goodwin's help. And Senator Peake, it's your office that's leading the fight in this, but George has been really the bulwark of this and has organized meetings, and it's been a very fruitful discussion. It's been very collaborative, and I think that legislation can go a long way to help all 95 counties in the Commonwealth, and we really appreciate it a lot. It's been very helpful.
That's what happens when y'all call me.
Trust me.
When that is like, they call me, we got a problem here. So we try to address them if we can, and this is one that's working out.
Is there anyone else?
Well, we're moving on.
I was just checking with any other agencies. Are there any other agencies that have anything else? Thank you for bringing that up. We had sat over there and talked about it, and I never brought it up while we're here. All right, Mr. O'Brien.
The only other issue, I've received about 20 emails in the last 2 days. Been asked to speak up for solar. I do think solar is important. Distributed solar is an area where Virginia is falling behind. Of course, there's lots of opportunities. There's a lot of interest on the part of people to reap the benefits of putting solar on their homes. I have a friend who just did it recently. I'd like to do it in my own business. And I think, unfortunately, we've kind of taken a turn away at the federal level, but I would certainly encourage at the state level that we look to promote solar energy. Regardless of what people say about climate change, as Michael is about to destroy Florida, it is something that we need to take seriously in terms of what are we doing and what's our footprint in the long term. So I am certainly speaking out for solar right now.
And I appreciate that. Y'all have any solar applications for solar farms in the county?
We have one solar farm that's 5 acres?
No, 42 or 43.
Well, we're getting a lot of individual residences that are now taking back, and they have to pay for it.
It's about
a 10-year payback, roughly. But the savings per month is effectively what you'll make that monthly payment. At about the 10-year point, so it's been presented. Then it's the loan's paid back, and you're getting that savings on the monthly bill.
And I'm hearing advertisements on the radio all the time in the Lynchburg area. Their panels are getting smaller, more efficient. So I'm not aware of it. I know one issue was the counties to the solar farms, and then in essence, the property's taken off the tax rolls, or you're not getting the benefit of what they're.
Right.
You're not getting any tax dollars from the electricity they're generating, and it's not being used as farmland, and then it can't be used for anything else. So I know that has come up, but I'm all for renewable energy.
And since I'll add to that, that's exactly right. It has to be a mega farm, solar farm, before you can start to tax it, and then you can only tax it to a very limited extent. So although it's great for the energy future, it doesn't help our county tax revenue much at all. All you get is the land, the tax on the land, right. And there's some question about it being in land use.
And it is plugged up for 20 years of no improvements.
They're about 30-year leases, what they're putting in place right now. And some county, you've got to do about 800 acres or more for it to be eligible for taxes, and then only at 20% of the cost. So it's a really great way to provide energy with very little impact, but it's not going to be the silver bullet for our tax revenue. That's the problem.
All righty. Well, thank you all for coming in today. We do appreciate you being so, well, you listen to us and you try to respond, and that's really a nice thing. When Mark said that, one of the first couples, when I first knowledge of the voter registration thing, first thing I did is pulled out my phone and started calling you guys, and the way that you jumped on it, we really appreciate that fact that we know you're within earshot.
Some of those things we can fix, but funding all the schools is not as quite as easy. We can't print money. Yeah.
All right. Well, you could, but we'd all be in trouble. All righty. Well, having said that, folks, y'all do not have a quorum, so y'all not in meeting.
And I'll just say thank you all. It really helps us when y'all all get together and have it at one time when everybody comes with their ideas and thoughts, because, you know, be the school board here and then board here and sheriff there, and we're happy to do it, but this is very helpful.
Sure. All righty. Thank you. Rob, did you want to say anything? All righty. Well, having said that, Mr. Bryan, we need to adjourn our meeting. Do I have a motion? Do I have a second? Motion's made by Mr. O'Brien, seconded by Ms. Booker. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Chair votes aye. Motion passes 4-0 with one absent. Thank y'all very much for coming out today.